we're going to bring our panelists up, and we want to really go deep on some of these great provocative ideas that Ted has brought forward. It's a fairly structured Q&A here. What I would like our panelists to do first is prepare a reaction to what Ted just said, a short one, 2 minutes. And I want everybody to be kind of working on that. I'm going to call you up individually. And then, as I think we told you before, we'd like you to prepare a couple of questions that we're then going to give to Ted, and you're going to react to his answer, and you're going to add to that or subtract from it. So, but first, let me get you all up, and if you'd please just join me one by one, moving to the left here. First, Mayor Steve Adler. He's been the mayor of Austin since January 2015. Come on up, Mayor. Mayor has put the crisis of Austin music at the top of his priorities next to traffic. He's going to hopefully will tell you more about his music and creative ecosystem stabilization recommendations. Next to him, we want Harold McMillan. He's a bass player, founder, director, everybody knows Harold, of Diverse Arts Culture Works, which is a nonprofit producer of culture projects. He's been a real creative force in Austin music for more than 20 years, a sort of liaison for artists and art in East Austin, a founder of the Clarksville Jazz and Arts Festival and the Austin Blues Family Tree Project. Next to him, we have Eve Monsay. My friend Eve, she's a blues guitarist with her husband Mike Buck. They're co-owners of Anton's Record Shop. She's got three CDs out. Next we have Will Bridges. And we can thank Will and Gary Clark Jr. for bringing Antone's back downtown earlier this year. He's also the owner-operator of Arlen Studios and of Lambert's Restaurant and the great Deep Eddy Cabaret with its amazing jukebox. Let's see. Next we have Nicole Boggetts. She's the Secretary-Treasurer of the Austin Music Federation. We get to Dr. John Mills, who longtime music fans know John. Jazz saxophonist, professor of jazz studies at the Butler School of Music here at UT, composer, arranger. He's performed on stage or recorded with Carla Bley, Butch Miles, Bonnie Raitt, Dr. John, Aretha Franklin, David Byrne. Presented jazz masterclasses all over the world, and he has been gigging in Austin since 1971. So he's seen a lot of changes. And finally, we'd like to round out this panel with Jennifer Houlihan. She's, many of us know her. She's the executive director of the Austin Music People for the last 5 years. Before that, she was the development director for the Long Center for the Performing Arts. All right. We'd like to start with some reactions to Ted's comments. And Mr. Mayor, let's start with you.
I thought what you said was dead on. This is a community that loves music. I got here in 1978. I came here for law school from the East Coast, grew up on the East Coast, went to college on the East Coast. Without any doubt at all, I was going to go to law school at the cheapest law school I could find because I could afford it, and then I was going to be back on the East Coast. And I fell in love with Austin while I was here, and I fell in love with Austin in no small part because of the music. The same thing that drives the music then, I think, is the same thing that is the spirit and soul of this city. And it manifests itself in lots of different ways. And it manifests itself in what is the tech thing that is happening in Austin now as well. It is the same creative pushing the envelope. It is the same thing that is not entertainment, but forces people to develop and to think, and to think outside the box, and to iterate. Austin, Texas has always been a city where it's okay to fail, which makes it different than others, because what that means is it's okay to try things. The people that get things right the first time are always suspect, because you never really know whether they're good or whether they were just lucky. It is all of the same thing, I think, that is what is special about this city. And with respect to music, we are at that fork in the road. We are at that crisis point. You don't lose 1,200 jobs. You don't lose the music venues that we're losing in this city and sustain yourself as the live music capital of the world. Best as I can tell, there's nothing worse than being the city that used to be the cool city. Austin's the cool city. There was we were number one on a lot of lists. There was a magazine not too long ago that identified Austin as being the city that was actually as cool as it thought that it was, which I think is kind of neat. But we're at that fork in the road. There are a lot of conversations we could have today about music, and what I loved about what you just said was it was almost entirely forward-looking. And that's the conversation that we have to have in this city right now. We are where we are. And in some respects, it's important for us to know how we got here so that we understand where we are, but only for that purpose. This is where we are, and now we have to figure out what it is that we do next in order to be able to sustain ourselves. Recognizing that there's eight of us up here and we probably only have about 3.5 minutes each to speak, and it being as forward-looking as I can think, and because we're in a very quiet, private place here with only 150 people, I went to Asia for an economic development trip in July. And while I was in Asia, there were a lot of people there from various chambers talking about lots of different ways to do economies. The conversation that I had when I was there that has haunted me the most and that I have spent the most time thinking about, and is the conversation that we're following up with, involved Alibaba. Do y'all know Alibaba? All right, Alibaba, 450 million active users, much bigger than eBay, much bigger than all the things that it is here. It's Asia, and they are trying really hard to figure out how it is that they can get into markets in the United States. And I went in with Alibaba for what I thought would be a relatively perfunctory 30-minute meeting, and I spent the entire afternoon with them. And they're sending people here now. And this is the kind of the homework assignment that I need help with. Because I'm involved in music in this city right now without knowing the industry, the people on this panel are people that have been invested in this music industry in so many ways that I'm the guy who goes to the club. I just like the music. Alibaba, we sit down and they say two things to me over the course of an hour conversation that I found really interesting. The first is they're toying with the idea of creating a page in their platform that's about Provence, France, because they think that one of the ways they can market that is to pick a region or a place and brand it and make it something special in that platform, obviously that they can use to sell off of. Hidden in this hour conversation, we also learn that the other thing that they want to figure out is how it is that Alibaba does music. It's the technology question that you were asking. So they have this huge platform, they have this huge tool, they have 450 million people on their platform. How do they tie technology to music? And the reason that we spent the afternoon together is I picked those points out and I said, this is Austin, Texas. This is Austin, Texas. If there is any city in the world that should be able to figure out that second component, and help you with the first component, because our brand, our city, is tied to music and now to technology. I said, forget the Provence page. You need an Austin page. And on that Austin page, with in addition to all the other things that could be Austin, on that Austin page, you need to figure out what that connection is. I have no idea what that connection is. But I do believe that the future of our city and our spirit and our soul has an element of figuring that out. And they're going to be coming to the city soon to engage in that conversation. That is, I think, an element of what you were talking about. I think it's incredibly exciting, and I think it is dead on.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. I think when you all have written your questions on the index cards, pass them that way, and Philip's going to collect them. And they're going to review the questions while you're giving a statement. Try to keep it to a couple of minutes. It's okay. We. Harold, you're up.
I enjoyed your talk. I didn't find anything controversial about it. I think me and the people that I talk to who are engaged either as consumers or producers of art and then trying to make it public, we talk about this stuff. Don't come up with any answers, but we talk about this stuff. So I don't think there's any controversy there. The part of what you said that kind of hits home with me is trying to tie that cultural piece, reintegrate it back into the economics and the technological part of it. And you mentioned the symbolic support and to be wary of that. We have a lot of experience with symbolic support here. We're the live music capital of the world. I don't know if you knew that. We're the live music capital of the world. The thing that I would hope that we would try to tie together goes back to you mentioning like New Orleans being a national park, that is the jazz park, you know, and that situation with Kansas City trying to decide on the name and the cultural heritage tours that go through Mississippi and that kind of thing. Those things have their problems, their issues, but for me, the problem that we have in Austin is that we are the live music capital of the world. And I can look out in the audience here. There are folks who are really, really good at what they do. And a lot of what they do kind of drips Austin. I mean, Austin has a sound in the various genres of music that live here. There is something about local cultural identity that's tied to it. I think the sad thing is that there is big money music business here, internationally known. But unlike Mississippi and Louisiana, there's not really a strong effort of those majors, the people that I call the majors, to celebrate the roots of Austin music here. I think the roots of Austin music ought to be at the core of some big international festival. Not just the fact that it's a beautiful city in the hill country that has really good drinks. And I could go on, but I won't.
I was glad you ended on a high note, because I mean, there are tons of challenges, obviously, and I appreciate what you said about looking forward and how you're looking at the potential and the want and desire for people to have quality music again. And it's you know, certainly a struggle for musicians in Austin. And I also look around at people here who are musicians, but they also have other projects that they're involved with. I sometimes feel like, you know, you go into the, it's like you go to the small town and the guy that's at the gas station is also the sheriff, and you know, we all have to wear a bunch of different hats. And sometimes I think that's really great, because that activity supports other things, but at other times I feel like we all get stressed out and spread really thin, and it's nice to just, you know that there is a lot of music that is appreciated here. I like what you were just saying, Harold, about Austin itself. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of great music that's come out of here. There's a lot of great music that continues to be formed here, and sometimes it just feels like it's overlooked, and, you know, it's a struggle for all of us. But one thing, just on a larger scale, Adele's last record, when it came out, it was not available on Spotify, and that was a huge deal. And it sold, I think, 3 million copies the first week, which was the, you know, it broke all kinds of records. And I'm wondering why more of that's not happening on a larger scale, because the companies are, record companies are making more money that way, I would think. So maybe that's another step in the right direction. Hopefully we'll see more of. And I guess that's about it for now.
So you covered a lot of ground in your talk, and my notes are sort of representative of that. They're a little all over the place. There are some correlations that were drawn, I think some more accurate than others, but the way I sort of break down the two components of what we're talking about tonight is really the way, and this is coming from somebody that grew up in Austin, so maybe I'm biased in this view, but I've always thought of it as there's the record business and there's the music business. And we've never been very good at the record business in Austin. We've had one major label ever in our city's history, I think, the Arista Records experiment, and that didn't last very long. So we've sort of always only known this kind of DIY model that now seems to be, you know, more prevalent. I wonder sometimes, I've got a lot of questions that didn't make it on the card, but, you know, I wonder sometimes, you know, when we look back, historians look back on our, you know, 100 years or even our 50 years and all that's transpired in music, if this is just a big learning curve, if this is just sort of a painful evolution, I wonder if the peak and success of the record business might have actually just been a detour for the music business. But I know that the thing that we long for here in Austin is seen. That's a word that I don't think gets used enough. Maybe that's an indicator of where we are on the scene health meter. It certainly used to be our strength. And so I was also pleased, you know, to hear that there's at least an optimistic kind of conclusion to this. I'm certainly optimistic. I feel like you can't be in this industry if you're not optimistic. Because we are, it is a passion industry. We're here because we love music and the way that it affects the world. And I think that in Austin right now, you know, our cup runneth over with fortune. A lot of it is economic fortune, or that's maybe the easiest way to sort of measure the result of the growth of our city. With the growth of Austin, a lot of new challenges have arisen, but a lot of new opportunities have arisen as well. So we need to be nimble. We need to be flexible. We need to, continue to not be sidetracked by the kind of who moved my cheese analogy, but rather go out and find new cheese and be optimistic that it's out there and we're going to find it. I also wanted to point out, and I don't mean this as a slight to anyone in this room, and at the ripe old age of 34, I can kind of now say this with a little chuckle myself, is that the future of music is actually not in this room. They're hopefully in their garages and basements and bedrooms, and they don't care what we think about the crisis of music, and I'm glad about that. I think we need to be very careful as a city, and I know we amended the title of this talk tonight, but I think we do need to be very careful about the message we're sending to the kids. Because we don't want it to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the last thing I'll say about that is when it comes to, you know, the big argument about government and music and subsidies and all that, I will say one thing, and this is the best point I've ever heard made about how to fix this crisis in music ever. And the person that said it said, I know the answer. Because we all know there's no silver bullet answer here. There's a laundry list of things we need to do, and we need to do all of them well. But I heard this, and I feel like this was the best. If there is one attempt at a silver bullet answer, it is music education. Kids are not learning what music really is. They're not learning about the craftsmanship, and so therefore, we expect them to understand the difference between, something complex and something simple, but yet we've never taught them what that is. So I think that is something that we need to be laser focused on as we move forward as adults, making sure that we're planting the seeds so that future generations can continue to evolve.
So I kind of come at this at a little bit of a different standpoint than most people on this panel. The Austin Federation of Musicians is actually the musicians union here in town. We are the local chapter of the American Federation of Musicians. And what the union kind of is looking at is, not only is Austin just a creative city and a great place to live, so many opportunities and many different facets of business in this town, but it is using the union as a point of looking at it as from professional musicians, people who are not wanting to be the people who just play in the garage or at the frat house parties, things like that. And so we hear a lot of times people complain about Sixth Street, right? Like, you can't make any money on Sixth Street. We're playing for bar tabs and things like that. When people come to me and ask me about professional musicians, I never once say anything about Sixth Street. And I hate to say that because, of course, at one point in time, we all were down there. That was the cool place to be. You know, Sixth Street used to not be the way that it is now, and even 20 years ago. It was a business district that then turned into a bunch of venues and dance places, and it got to be really cool. There is no money to be made down on Sixth Street anymore. And for lack of a better word, it is a cluster you know what. So when people come to me and ask about where are we supposed to perform, I tell everybody stay away from Sixth Street. You know, you want to go to these places. Easily talk to Eve, talk to Will, talk to John. These people have been around for long enough that they know where the good places are, and they want to help the upcoming musicians. A lot of times we hear that people say, well, I don't have anybody to turn to. There's AMP, there is HAM. There's so many different organizations in this town. Again, I think the number was close to 140 this time, that are able to help. So most of it is taking your craft seriously and your partner's craft seriously. A lot of times, again, hate to bring up Sixth Street, but they go and play for a $25 bar tab, they're undercutting the next person who's trying to make it in there, and our business is now lost. People cannot make money that way. And so artists in trying to make a living in this town are having to work twice as hard to show that they are professional and that they do deserve to actually make a livable wage. If musicians supported each other and used this as a business and treated their craft like a real craft, just like the person who's the electrician wants to get paid for them going in and putting lighting in your housing, it needs to be done for each other so that people do not have to leave Austin to go make money and use Austin as just a creative place to maybe get together with some people and write some music. They're going outside of Austin. So what's happening? South by Southwest comes in, all these tourists come in, people from all over the world. Yes, it sounds great, like it brings in tons of money to our town, but what happens? They leave. And the musicians who have been here struggling, or maybe back in the 70s, 80s, had a career, a huge career. It has now been crushed. And it's been crushed by the venues who do not want to pay musicians a livable wage, and the other musicians who have helped downgrade the next musician and undercut the next musician. And if we all can work together and build each other up and use things like this. The Austin Music Census, all the hours that were put into that were for a purpose. But if we all as a community, and even as the audiences and the music lovers in this town, even if they aren't musicians, take this seriously, We could be so much better than where we are at now. And we could follow what Ted has been saying and do a much better job of having the live music capital of the world and not dwindle.
Okay, Nicole, I've got to follow up on that because I think it's sort of against musicians' nature to work collectively. There's sort of that view of, you know, somehow being independent from everybody, including other musicians, mm-hmm. unfortunately. That not only affects the sort of undercutting in the live scene that's, I mean, right now, just in the last years, I hear about bands playing for free everywhere. I mean, I've been here as we gave away, you know, 45 years here, and that was never the case. I mean, this wasn't a place where people made a lot of money, but musicians didn't play for free. You know, historically, we have an undercutting going on. We have a similar kind of undercutting going on where YouTube is concerned. Ted, you brought that up. Here's a case where if I don't give it away, do I even exist? And it's very hard for a single musician, if you're not Taylor Swift or somebody or Adele, to say, no, I'm not going to put my music on YouTube. It's you're sort of coerced into it if you're going to even be available. You know, if somebody hears that you play music and they can't then after that conversation view you on YouTube, it's like, well, that guy must have been fake because I didn't see him on YouTube. So there's that pressure, which sort of demands this sort of collective thinking, which again is sort of against our nature. I hope we can solve that somehow, but that addresses both of those things. The problem with the YouTube situation where the whole source of a stream of income, and even though, as has been noted here, Austin is always somewhat in the backwater in terms of the music industry and the backing of record companies, etc., there was still some peripheral action of musicians of a certain age and maturity that profited, found ways to make money. Oh, you know, I've been on the road with the band for, I'm ready to move, you know, maybe do some management, maybe produce some recordings. There was more of an economy that came from this sense of moving forward, and now we're kind of stuck, so many people just at the entry level. Okay, there's superstar, there's entry level, what is there in between? And I think this, you know, sort of a highway robbery of royalties and things that were just sort of done arbitrarily and uncontested with the new technology has wiped out that, you know, the sort of the you know, middle ground, the you know, survival of musicians, which is the natural progression, I think, of musicians here in a lot of places. 20 years, you're playing the bars and you're driving around state playing bands. People typically moved into other areas of, you know, responsibility toward making recordings and all those various ways to do it. And I just think that national issue of a lack of any kind of fair compensation for those views has impacted our live scene in that way and frustrated people because there's no natural progression anymore. Okay, so.
How do I follow all that up? I'm used to speaking at City Hall where they have a timer to tell you when you have to be quiet. So I will try to keep this short. I think the most powerful thing that you shared with us today was the idea that all of these different qualities of the music scene, the cultural scene, the economic scene, the business practices, they're all interwoven. And they're not independent of one another. You can't address one and hope the other ones catch up. I think in Austin, something that we've seen is in some ways the music is a canary in a coal mine, that the issues that are facing all kinds of Austinites, affordability, healthcare costs, worrying about what can we be a one-car family, is the public transportation system good enough? All of those challenges show up in music and we hear them loud and clear. So if there's a way for us as a community to be of service in a larger way to our city, I think that's an opportunity that we should feel privileged to take to be telling the stories about affordable housing, telling the stories about problems with the transportation grid, telling the stories about needing HAM for our healthcare or SIMS for our mental health care, needing Austin Music Foundation to teach us how to write a business plan, to teach us how to put together our first tour, to know if we're ready to call an agent or not. That's a way for us as a music community to transform Austin while making our lives better at the same time. So I appreciate you bringing the perspective to us that is so much larger than just who's on a radio station. I won't pick a particular one. Whose record got played this week. It's also about who had, I'll close with this, I got a thank you note today from a local musician. I had gotten a call from a city office that was looking for someone to come and play at a family-friendly event. And I had experience with this artist. I knew they were approved as a city vendor. I said, if they're available, these guys be great. I got a thank you note today. And she said, you know, that thank you for the referral. It wasn't a big contract, but it made all the difference for our daughter because she loves tacos. And this month was a really good month for our family budget, and we had a lot of tacos. Those are the conversations that we have, and I hope we can bring those larger conversations and lift everybody up.
We're gonna go till probably a little past 9 o'clock. You all probably have some questions. The way we've structured this, the questions are going to be from the panel, and we welcome everybody to go to the Parish Hall, which is just east of here. There's going to be great music by Phillips Trio. There's going to be beverages and food and pizza. So, if you have a question, you know, you're going to have access to all these folks. So, that's the plan. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question, and then we're going to find out who wrote this down and get them to respond as well. Let's see. If the future of music is indeed returning to a focus on the art form, how should musicians most appropriately monetize their art in a capitalist economy?
Whose question was that?
Yeah.
Anyone want to take ownership of that? Okay. I have got a view of the future of music technology that I was only able to sketch out in a very brief way tonight. But it's a much bigger vision. Example I give is I ask the question, what was the Apple computer of the 1930s? What was the Apple computer of the 1940s? It was a company called RCA. The Steve Jobs of that era was a fellow named David Sarnoff, who owned RCA. And they made the devices back then. They weren't phones, but they were like record players, radios. They later invented the color television. But they viewed themselves as a music company. They saw themselves as a music company, not a machine company. They didn't make equipment. And they actually had musicians under contract. They had George Gershwin under contract. They had Rachmaninoff under contract. They had Louis Armstrong under contract. Later, they had Elvis Presley under contract. Because of that, they created technologies that supported the artist within a capitalist system. They invented the 45 RPM single, which made huge amounts of money for lots of musicians. Now check this out, this is a great story. RCA invented the color television and got it into everybody's home in the United States. You know why they did that? Not to sell the TV, they owned NBC, the TV network. And they wanted to be able to distinguish the content, the artistic programming on NBC by using color. And they needed people to get the device so that they would watch the program. The technology supported the art. Now, what you have going on today with Apple and Google is the art supports the technology. The technology is like a parasite that uses the art for its own economic benefit. The way to conceptualize this, the last 20 years there's been a battle between Northern California and Southern California. Hollywood in Southern California represents creativity, Northern California and Silicon Valley represents technology. What nobody has told you is that war is already over and the creative people lost it. What we need is World War II now. We need a new generation of technology in which the technology uplifts the art, supports the art, and empowers the art. And they can do that within a capitalist economy. It's been done before. RCA did it. I could give you many examples. All you need to do is to put creative people now making the decisions on what technology uplifts and financially supports them. If we had more time, I would go into it. But there is opportunity here. There's no reason for pessimism. These problems can be solved. It's just the people in the industry now are not going to give you the solutions. We need to create new ones. It could happen here in Austin.
Well, I think my answer to the same question would be the live performance. And again, coming from a live performance town, we aren't as quick to think about the record industry, because everything you talked about was still talking about a recorded version of the performance. But the origin of the art form is the live performance. And somewhere along the evolution of the record business, that changed and it became more valuable to monetize the recorded performance. I think what we're seeing is a reversal of that. We're certainly seeing it on a granular level because artists, there's no question, are making more via live performances. Something we've talked a lot about the recorded music industry, but ticket prices for established acts are probably higher than they ever have been. The festival model is at an all-time high. Some of that is probably too inflated, but I think the limitation of the artistic expression of music is that you can only be in one place at one time, and so it's when we try and scale beyond that. You need technology, and that you often also lose control because you need partners. So I don't know the answer, but I hope it has something to do with the live performance.
Okay, next question. Our elected officials deal with multiple worthy competing demands. Where does music, where do both arts and entertainment, fit into a music city's priorities?
Okay. This is a complex issue. I just want to say, on a philosophical basis, you cannot measure the impact of music solely in dollars and cents. Now, clearly here in Austin, the music is bringing in lots of money in terms of just the size there. I'm just saying, in terms of how you prioritize it, you cannot say, let me put it the way my brother does. My brother ran the National Endowment for the Arts. Well, he says that some things you can measure in terms of dollars, but there's some things that you cannot put a price tag on. And I think music is like that. So I would say you've got to have that intangible support for music over and above its impact on the economy. You've got a great music business here, but I would say that this is one of the two or three things that really define what Austin is. I am not an Austinite. When I think of Austin, I think of the tech center here. I think of music. I probably think of food. There's a very small number of people. So it's got to be in the top five priorities. And if the numbers don't measure that, then the numbers are missing out. That's philosophical. You could get into more details, but philosophically, that's how I believe.
Okay. Do you want to add anything to that? I'm going to try to paraphrase this one. What do you see as how Austin can do better in enhancing its symbolic gesture, live music capital of the world? Where should it do better to sort of put actions behind the symbolic gesture?
Whose question was that? Okay. I talked about the MTV Music Awards. I said 2 weeks ago nobody watched it. The ratings were down 34%. I could add, you could watch that show for an hour and not see a single musical instrument. it was almost as if musical instruments don't exist. And even the people that do the programming and the beats or the samples, none of them, only people you could see singing, but any other aspect of music was hidden from view. And I thought it was awful that 2 days later, Britney Spears, who had been at the MTV Music Award, launched her Las Vegas show. And in the Las Vegas show, there was a huge guitar, but it was a prop. It was an enormous guitar. She sort of straddled it. Like, well, you can fill in the Freudian imagery there. Okay, this is the music instrument is now a prop. And I believe part of the problem with the ratings is they took the M out of MTV. They've taken the music out of the music business. And so I believe that Austin very shrewdly is saying it is the live music capital of the world. That is a valuable slogan, and the key thing is you've got to make sure it's more than a slogan, and the beautiful thing is you've got the ingredients here to make it happen. I would just say, do not minimize the importance of this, because I believe in the next 5, 10, 15 years, they're going to rediscover the M. And the idea that the music business re-embraces the musical aspects of it, that is really something attuned to the strengths here in Austin.
Any punctuation on that, Nicole? Just an amen, right? Okay. So hanging on that thought for a second, is the health or viability of a live music scene impacted by the destruction of the publisher-composer royalty system?
Oh boy. Who?
Yeah. That was a long time ago.
If there are music publishers in the room, they're not going to want to hear what I have to say. This antiquated system we have goes back to the 1920s, when the music publisher got your song recorded, got it performed. The music publisher did a lot of things. Nowadays, my view is the music publisher is sucking up a huge percentage of the income and royalty and not delivering the same amount of value. If you have a hit record, the publisher can make more than the musician. And I ask myself, what value did the publisher actually add? They're not even publishing anything anymore. Now, I know if there are publishers in the room, you're going to come at me afterwards, and you're going to tell me all the great things you do. But I fundamentally believe the value created by music is now being allocated, and the people who are getting the lion's share of it are not delivering value that deserves that payment. I believe the same thing about the record labels. The record labels used to make you into a star. You would sign with the label, you'd sign with the man, and it usually was a man back then. And the idea is you signed away and they made you into a star. Well, nowadays they're doing very little. They're just like passing the files onto the streaming company, sucking in a huge portion of the royalties. And so you've got an antiquated structure in which a disproportionate amount of the wealth created by the music industry is going to people that don't deliver commensurate value. This is a tremendously controversial thing for me to say. Trying to change it would be almost impossible, but this would be the right thing to do so that the creative people, and this is what I say, why don't you let the musician decide whether they want to pay a publisher? Give the musician choice. They can keep the publisher royalty themselves, or they can individually decide to sign with the publisher. They're not allowed to make that decision. You're on the radio, the publisher gets the royalties. And so I believe that the whole system in which the money is divvied up in the music industry is broken and needs to be fixed. The problem is the musicians don't have the lobbying voice to allow that change to happen. And even me saying these things will be viewed by many as absolute heresy. Well, I think that qualifies as
well. That's a good answer. But I even if you don't dispute the traditional 50-50 split between composer and publisher, and you're going with that, the big difference is not that the publisher is getting much. The whole royalty went from being what was negotiated with a lot of difficulty in the radio days for what, you know, has been the way, and now it's, oh, it's instead of it's the internet instead of a radio, so now there are no rules. So rather than dispute the 50-50 between a publisher and an artist, It's like we used to be talking about splitting up a loaf of bread, and now we're splitting up crumbs.
Well, no, but and you're absolutely right. I'm just saying there's a big picture issue of when a record becomes a hit, who captures the value versus who created that value? And I'm saying that formula is so totally messed up that the single biggest reason why the music creative side is in crisis is because there are huge numbers of people taking a disproportionate amount of that. And you raised one of them, and there's this whole, but what, see, the end of this, as you can see, is the money is divided up based on who can hire the most lobbyists. That's my view. And it's hard to fix, but it could be fixed. It could be fixed with technology, too. I see a world in which the musician gets to decide whether they need a publisher and what to pay that publisher. Musician gets to decide whether they need a label and what to pay that label. Maybe they don't even need a label anymore. The labels aren't offering proportional value. So I would like to take not just the one issue you raised, but all of these. I'd like to have a blank sheet of paper and say, how do you rewrite the value allocation in the music business? That's a huge issue well beyond Austin. It's a huge issue, but I believe it's important.
What would you tell the Greater Austin Chamber of Commerce to help them understand the return on investment on bringing significant music industry investment to Austin? There we go again.
I don't think there's a faster way to turbocharge things here than to steal companies from elsewhere. Anything you could do to bring major music companies from elsewhere and convince them to set up at least an office here. And the city's been great at doing things like this. And I know it's on the mayor's plan. I'm not selling him anything he doesn't already know. I'm just saying to get the business community together and see what can we do to create the right business environment for music businesses, that could have a huge impact. And I think we could really dream big because these music businesses now are in New York and LA, and there are a lot of problems operating in those environments. And they won't say it publicly, but if you talk to these people privately, they'll tell you all the problems they face doing a music business where it is now. I do think the business community, and not just the business community in a traditional way, the venture capital community, and they all have a part to play in this and could be a part of a very vibrant Austin music scene.
I would add to that the regulatory environment, at least in our research, has proven to be a big factor, not just for whether businesses are attracted to relocate to Austin, but it's also been a factor for our venues on a case-by-case basis. It's been a factor for our festivals. And the city is working hard to retool its permitting process to make it more friendly. But I think it's something that we can't forget. It's probably the least sexy thing that will be said tonight, but policy is so important. And if I could ask everyone here to do one thing, that would be to make sure you are registered to vote and make sure that we're voting in music-friendly people who will make music-friendly policy, because that's what we're going to need to have the stability underneath this industry is a regulatory environment that makes it safe to be healthy and operate.
Yeah. All right, one more question. And then as an Episcopalian, I need a cold beer. So we're gonna do one more of these, Ted. Social media and outlets like YouTube have led people to expect music for free, but have the potential to reach new music lovers. What's one way we can help use that outreach to help people appreciate the value of that music?
It's a big issue. Whose question is that? Okay, that's a great question. YouTube has had a huge impact in creating the idea that music is free. And there are all sorts of solutions to this. There are technological ones, there are legal ones. And let me give you an example of something that happened in Germany last week you may not be aware of. There were a couple of things. One is to give nightclubs the same tax breaks as art museums and symphony orchestras. But the other ruling in Europe that people didn't notice is they decided in the EU that a lawsuit that if you click on a link to creative content, Google, the search engine, has to pay the creator of the creative content. Now, you know what company won this lawsuit? It was Playboy. So the idea is you get paid for your content if you take off your clothes. If you keep your clothes on, you don't get paid right now. But still, the precedent has been set. The precedent has been set in this one situation that if Google is sending people to this creative content, they've got to share some of the money. That is a legal solution to it. There are also technological solutions. I really believe the next generation of technology has to be run as a cooperative thing for musicians in which they create their own destiny. You know, I was working with a tech company that was going to do, you put up your own video for music lessons. You're a musician. I teach people how to play the guitar with these videos, and I set whatever price I want on the guitar lesson. And my view is once we establish that, we're going to convince the person to put their music up and create, we need platforms that empower musicians, but there are a number of solutions to this. It's just, if we keep on doing things the way they are, the folks that run YouTube are never going to help us out. We need alternatives, and they have to come from creative people outside of the current power structure. You say that, you reminded me that Austin has never been much about the record industry. That may be your single best advantage, because you have no allegiance to this dead way of doing business that somebody's got to shake up. It could happen here. It should happen here.
All right. Let's give a big thanks to Ted Gioia for joining us in Austin.